I was sick a long time ago, yet the effects are still with me. So I did the Friday Night Live last night, and in the evening my voice is worse, so that it tends to progressively get worse, and it sounded like I was a smoker. But I did get through the Friday Night Live, and it's doing pretty good now, but hopefully it'll hold out because be able to do the sermon as well this afternoon. So we are starting, obviously this is the first time that we are doing live Bible studies here. Mr. Henson has done it online, where people were able to tune in. But we're starting that up again where it is live. So we will be kind of handing it off to one another. I have the first set. He will pick up where I leave off. And so next month he will be doing the second Bible study to this. We're starting in 1 Samuel. And we're going to be going through the history, which has a lot to do with our present day and future. So a lot that we can learn there. But the 1 Samuel is where we are beginning. So here's a little bit of an introduction to the book of 1 Samuel. The books of Samuel originally were one volume, just a little bit of a background. It was one volume, just like Kings were one volume. It would have been one of the largest volumes in the Bible. But they did split that up. There was an easy division to split the book. 1 Samuel ends with the death of Saul. So you're looking at the reign of Saul, along with some other information that goes along in there. 1 Samuel has a lot that's going on in there. And 2 Samuel begins with the reign of David. So it was a really good division to be able to cut it in half and make two different books out of that. A clear division to be able to make two. The prominent figures. So the prominent figures in 1 Samuel are, of course, Samuel himself. Samuel being in there, then you have Saul and you have David. Those will be three key figures as we're moving through this. Who are the other major players when looking at this besides Samuel, Saul, and David, as they are obviously the key to that, but who are the others? Well, Eli the priest plays a big part at the beginning of the story. He comes into it. Also, the Philistines. The Philistines were connected to the Sea Peoples, and if you're looking through history, that's something you'll find, the Sea Peoples. The Sea People were possibly the ones that destroyed the Hittite Empire, which for a long time, archaeology and different people thought the Hittites were just made up by the Bible. They couldn't find any evidence. Now there's a plethora of evidence out there. There's no way to deny it anymore. But it thought that the Philistines were the ones to destroy that empire. Notable Philistines are, of course, Goliath. We know that story. And also Achish. And that's one that we don't know as well as Goliath. But Achish is a Philistine that befriends David. They actually have a friendship that continues. The Philistines have five principal cities: Ashkelon, Ashdod, Ekron, Gath, and Gaza, which is interesting because today that also comes into the news that we listen to. We hear a few of those cities as well. There are five lords to the Philistines. That plays a part in it, who rule. And other notable peoples are the Ammonites and the Amalekites that come into it. That is pretty much it. That is what you're looking at in the story of 1 Samuel. That's the background to it. That's the big players within the story itself. What is leading up to the book of Samuel? Okay, well, after the Exodus out of Egypt, Israel wandered in the wilderness for 40 years. We know that. We revisit that story every Days of Unleavened Bread, and then also sprinkled throughout the year, we revisit that story. After the 40 years, the next generation enters the Promised Land. So they actually enter the Promised Land under the leadership of Joshua. After Joshua's death, it's handed down to elders. The elders lead Israel at that time, and then after the elders die, they would then go into a time of doing what is right in their own eyes. That is the time of the judges and being able to do what is right in their own eyes. This leads into a time that there is a cycle that plays out. We've heard this before. That cycle is: one, Israel would go against what God commanded, what God said. Two, they would be persecuted for a time. Three, they would cry out to God. Four, God would send a deliverer, which would be a judge. And five, they would have a time of peace, and then the whole cycle would begin again. that would just continue through the time of the judges. And Samuel is the last judge of this sort. He is the one that kind of ends that era. He is a prophet judge. To put a title on him, he is a prophet judge. Let's go ahead and go to 1 Samuel 7. Our history, this is what is so fascinating about all of this. Our history connects to this history. History of the church, history of the people. 1 Samuel 7, verse 15. 1 Samuel 7, verse 15 says, "And Samuel judged Israel all the days of his life. He went from year to year on the circuit of Bethel, Gilgal, and Mizpah, and judged Israel in all those places. But he always returned to Ramah, for his home was there. There he judged Israel, and there he built an altar to the Lord." So this was part of his calling. He was a faithful judge to God. Samuel has a great name when it comes into the Bible, as he was very faithful to God. Samuel was a tool used to bring Israel back to God. Let's back up to verses 2 through 4. Verses 2 through 4, this was kind of what I would consider more of the character of Samuel, what he brought. It said, "So it was that the ark remained in Kirjath-Jearim a long time. It was there 20 years, and if you remember right before this, the Philistines actually took the ark, and they had it for a little while, only to, as quickly as they could, give it back because of different things that were happening within them, within their camps. So it was not where it was normally supposed to be. But they finished this out, "and all the house of Israel lamented after the Lord. Then Samuel spoke to all the house of Israel, saying, 'If you return to the Lord with all of your hearts, then put away the foreign gods and the asterisks from among you, and prepare your hearts for the Lord, and serve him only. And he will deliver you from the hand of the Philistines.' So the children of Israel put away the Baals and the asterisks and served the Lord only." It kind of gives you this picture of who Samuel was. He was a character that people listened to. He was respected, but he was also very faithful to God. It shows that picture that he was an educator of God's way of life. But they began under the judgment of Samuel to serve God again. Israel proved over and over that they needed a strong ruler to lead them. That was the picture. They needed somebody to lead them. To lead themselves was to do what is right in their own eyes. At some point, I'll give a sermon on that phrase and how we can even see that today. But author and date, not always so easy when looking at this. At least part of Samuel we would feel is written, or the information was supplied by Samuel, whether it was compiled by it, whatever, but Samuel was the one that would at least supply it or write it himself. After Samuel's death, we know that someone would have finished the writing. Who that is, there are different ideas such as Abiathar or others such as Nathan and Gad, which I think is just throwing names out there because we really don't know. After his death, we have no idea really who wrote it. But the information was definitely there. The date of authorship would partly be at the time of Samuel, obviously when he was alive and after, but it's not so clear. The dates of the main figures, those are pretty much set, but the date of the writing is not. So the figures themselves, that's set. The writing is not. That doesn't do anything for us, whether we have the exact date it's written or not. But we do know that it was inspired and God's written word. We're going to pick up in the story of where the people of Israel reject God, they reject Samuel, and ask for a king. But ultimately, we learn that it was not a rejection of Samuel, but a rejection of God completely. They want a different form of leadership. I do have an outline that I left in my bag out there that everyone, I was going to hand out to everyone. It gives you the outline of the First Samuel, kind of the breakout of the chapters themselves and what we're going to be looking at. And I can see, oh, you do, okay. Yeah, so one per family. I only have 40 in there. I was thinking one per family. If it runs out, tough. No, I will print off more or send it out to you if you would like that. So First Samuel 8, and we will pick it up in verse 1. That's where we're going to begin within the story. 1 Samuel 8 and verse 1 says, "Now it came to pass when Samuel was old that he made his sons judges over Israel." And there's a couple things that we can get from this. The stage is being set for another issue that arises. The Bible loves to do that. Let's set the stage, and then let's go into either the problem or whatever it might be. And that's what they're doing here for an issue that arises. But also a condition that will change the course of Israel's history. That's what this one verse is doing. It will it's leading into something that will change Israel's history forever from this point forward. The first thing that we get here is that Samuel is old. It's very quickly how he becomes old. The previous chapter, he's not as old, and all of a sudden he is, kind of shows that there's little detail there, but that they have a little bit of peace under the leadership of Samuel, a blessing of God. A second thing is that he made his sons judges. But as often is the case, the sons did not have the same integrity, did not have the same character as Samuel. That becomes a problem if that's how you're fixing things to be. Verse 2 said, "The name of his firstborn was Joel, and the name of his second, Abijah. They were judges in Beersheba. But his sons did not walk in his ways. They turned aside after dishonest gain, took bribes, and perverted justice." This became an issue very quickly. Obviously, well, I mean, it's not hard to figure out why this becomes an issue. It becomes an issue. Immediately, the new leadership is going down a familiar path toward corruption. Israel knew their history very well. We've been down this path before, and they don't like that. They don't like that at all. They are more towards the southern part of the area, while Samuel is more towards the northern part. And I think we can see here clearly that Samuel wanted to be able to have strong representation across the whole area. But God is very clear on this subject of what not to do. We will come back to this. Let's go to Deuteronomy 16. Deuteronomy 16, verse 18. Deuteronomy 16, verse 18 says, "You shall appoint judges and officers in all your gates, which the Lord your God gives you according to your tribes, and they shall judge the people with just judgment." Already there's something that has to be in place. There's a character that has to be involved. Verse 19, verse 18 is the "you shall." This is what you shall do. Verse 19 begins the "you shall not." "You shall not pervert justice. You shall not show partiality, nor take a bribe. From a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and twists the words of the righteous." So this is the "you shall not" section. These are the things that take away peace, takes away stability, takes away trust. There's nothing good that comes from that. Just look at our own political system and you say, "Do you trust your politicians?" And every single one of us would say, "I don't know that I do." And that is something that here, once you start putting these things in place, it creates an instability. A society that has perverted justice abundantly in a society where the subjects of that society don't feel safe. Let alone the most important aspect, that these are contrary to God's character. Israel, again, was not, Israel is to pursue God's character. He hates things like that. Let's go to Zechariah 8. We'll come back to 1 Samuel. Zechariah 8. In verse 16, Zechariah 8, verse 16. Zechariah 8, verse 16 says, "These are the things you shall do. Speak each man the truth of his neighbor, to his neighbor. Give judgment in your gates for truth, justice, and peace. Let none of you think evil in the heart against your neighbor, and do not leave a false oath. For all these are things that I hate," says the Lord. Came directly from the mouth of God. You can find very similar things written throughout the Bible that God hates that. God hates dishonesty. He doesn't want that at all. God hates this way of thinking. This way of thinking and acting were not to be part of the Israelite people. It wasn't to be part of how they lived, how they treated people. Let's go back to 1 Samuel 8. 1 Samuel 8, again, verse 3, says, "But his sons did not walk in his ways. They turned aside after dishonest gain, took bribes, and perverted justice." It's amazing how fast that creeps in. When reports like this happen, it causes worry to spread. Take our modern day again society. Do we have widespread trust in our system and everything that's going on? Do we believe what they say? Do we believe the justice system? We see rottenness that we don't want to see in a country that we live in. We don't want that. We don't want to see it. They didn't either. That is what's happening here. They see this. They don't like it. They don't want any part of it. They know their history. They know what's happened. This is something they're well aware of. And all of a sudden, it starts them worrying about the whole situation. Verse 4 says, "Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah and said to him, 'Look, you are old.'" Okay, first issue, you are old. We trust you. You're strong. Your character's good. But there's a time limit. The hourglass is running out. "So you are old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now make us a king to judge us like all the nations." Pretty interesting. Here's the problem. Now here's our solution. And you say, wait a second, it's only a matter of time until that same problem arises. Now this came as no surprise to God. Actually, it was said that this would happen. Let's go to Deuteronomy 17. Hold your finger here. Deuteronomy 17, God inspired Moses to say this because he knew this was going to happen. Deuteronomy 17, pick it up in verse 14. Deuteronomy 17, verse 14, says, "When you come to the land which the Lord your God is giving you and possess it, when you are there and dwell in it," which they are at the point that we're reading, "and say, 'I will set a king over me like all the nations that are around me.'" Verse 15, "You shall surely set a king over you whom the Lord your God chooses, one from among your brethren. You shall set as king over you. You may not set a foreigner over you who is not your brother." All of a sudden, there could be problems there. This was not a surprising thing that many years down the road, they asked for a king. So here in Deuteronomy, it says it doesn't show the rejection of having a king, verse looking to God. Let's go back to 1 Samuel 8. 1 Samuel 8 and verse 5. So we just read that already and said to him, "Look, you are old and your sons do not walk in your ways. There's a problem here. The time's running out. Now make us a king to judge us like other nations." It gives us a glimpse into the fear of the people. They didn't want to go down the road that many of their ancestors went down. We need to secure this. On a physical level, and I'm only saying on a physical level, you can kind of see their fear working out. You can kind of see them trying to, let's fix this. Let's do what we can. They could see the writing on the wall. You know, "Samuel, you are not going to be around for a while. Your sons are not righteous judges. You leave them in control and we will be persecuted again. It's going to happen very quickly. We have the solution. Make us a king." Now, this was hurtful to Samuel and it made him angry. Verse 6 said, "But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, 'Give us a king to judge us.' So Samuel prayed to the Lord. And the Lord said to Samuel, 'Heed the voice of the people and all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them, according to all the works which they have done since the day that I brought them out of Egypt, even to this day, with which they have forsaken me and served other gods, so they are doing to you also.'" This becomes the meat of the issue. And wanting a king, they are rejecting God. But Samuel's hurt too. He's the one physically there. He's hurt. But Samuel was the prophet to the people for God. Ultimately, this was a rejection of God. This becomes a serious issue. It was a rejection of God. This shows an issue that linked from the time of Exodus through this time now. The issue is faith in God and his protection. It is a spiritual issue. They don't realize this, but what they have before them is a spiritual issue. They have the solution that's been with them this whole time. But it's a spiritual issue. They're looking for a physical solution for, again, a spiritual problem. Obedience to God would give them all the protection that they would ever need if they could just take that step of faith that God would do that. And he's proven it, and he proves it through the time of the kings even, but it's a step that very few actually ever take that put their faith in God. Verse 9. Now therefore, heed their voice. However, you shall solemnly forewarn them and show them the behavior of the king who will reign over them. So Samuel told all the words of the Lord to the people who asked him for a king. So God is extremely fair. He does this throughout time for his people now, all the way then. He doesn't just spring something on them and say, okay, you made the choice, live with it. God doesn't do that. He's extremely fair. He doesn't give in to their request. He wants them to have all the details to make the request final. He wants them to understand. He wants them to know what it would be like. When those who reject God... speeding things along, I tried to take something out. I have a little bit of a side note here. This is a lesson for us today. God doesn't do anything unless we have proper notice. When we sin, we're given ample instruction, the ability to gain instruction. And he gives that to us. He doesn't just, when we sin, it's not like we are completely ignorant of what that sin was. We understand it. God's given us that. When those who reject God and go into the lake of fire, they will all have that information to make that choice. They will have that information. It will be a clear rejection of God. It will not be unfair. God doesn't work that way. And that's what he's doing here. He's saying, okay, I'm going to give you the information. Then you make your final chance about the king. Here in 1 Samuel, God is doing all of that. He is informing them so that they would not be ignorant. Verse 11, and he said, this will be the behavior of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them for his own chariots to be his horsemen, and some will be run before his chariots. He will appoint captains over his thousands and captains over his fifties, or his fifties, will set some to plow his ground and reap his harvest, and some to make his weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. This has a lot more to do with forced labor than it has to do with military. Different times I've read over that, and I kind of just thought military. This is more of forced labor within the kingdom. The NIV has, he will take your sons and make them serve. They won't have a choice how the king will work. We will make you serve. They would be appointed to do something, and there isn't much you could do about it. Jameson Bossett Brown adds, in the East, a person must accept any office to which he may be nominated by the king, however irksome it may be, to his taste or ruinous to his interest. Didn't matter. You don't like doing it, doesn't matter. I appointed you to it. You have to do it. Is there any way to get more light? There is not. All right. I have a lot of shadows. I'm my own shadow right now, and it's making it interesting to read. Verse 13, he will take your daughters to be perfumers, cooks, and bakers, and he will take the best of your fields, your vineyards and your olive groves, and give them to his servants. He will take a tenth of your grain and your vintage and give it to his officers and servants. Verse 16, and he will take your male servant, your female servant, your finest young men and your donkeys and put them to his work. He will take a tenth of your sheep, and he will you will be his servants. And you will cry out in that day because of your king, whom you have chosen for yourselves, and the Lord will not hear you in that day. He's laying it out. He's putting it all before them. We are going to go through the history of the kings, and it's all built off the backdrop of these verses. That small section, everything that we read from this point forward when we're working with the kings, is built off of that instruction. He gave it to them. Again, from that point forward, 8 verses, the kings act in that way. But even the good kings, it's how the kingdom operates. Israel did not know what it had in God. They had the perfect leader. They had the perfect king. They had the perfect protection. All of that. But it did take effort of faith. And that is something that was very difficult. I can't say it's not difficult now. We have to have faith as well, and it's not always the easiest thing. Can't just always down them about that. I've had my own trip-ups with it, but it is something they had right before them. It was something that they always had walking next to them. Verse 19, nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel, and they said, no, but we will have a king over us, that we also may be like all the nations, and that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. That's kind of a picture that they built in their mind. This is what the king's going to do. Everything's going to be great. Once we have a king, this is how it's going to work out. Israel has a very interesting view of this. God desired Israel to be set up so that Israel could be a model nation to all other nations. How they lived, the way they walked, the way they talked, how they thought, how they worshiped the one true God, all of those things. Yet here, they want to be like the other nations. That's what they're doing. If we could just be like everyone else, they have it good. We want a physical solution to a physical problem. We want a governmental structure that will take care of all the problems. If we could have that, that'd be great. The world throughout history has been looking for that governmental structure. They've never found it. They won't find it until the return of Jesus Christ and on from that point. They won't find it. Verse 21, "And Samuel heard all the words of the people, and he repeated them in the hearing of the Lord. So the Lord said to Samuel, 'Heed their voice and make them a king.' And Samuel said to the men of Israel, 'Every man go to his city.'" The people requested, and they will receive that. Remember the stipulation, the king is of the brethren and of whom God will choose. They don't get to choose whoever. It's of who God chooses. So they might get a king, but God still has a major part in that. Chapter 9. We'll make it through chapter 9, hopefully. Let's see what time it is. Okay, so chapter 9, verse 1. Says, "There was a man of Benjamin whose name was Kish, the son of Abiel, the son of Zor, the son of Bacharath, the son of Aphia, a Benjamite, a mighty man of power." So in the New King James, it uses the word power, and that can kind of give you a different feeling, that word power. This can be confusing in how we use it. Many commentaries in the meaning of the word has it as a man of great wealth. When we read that as a man of great wealth, it's somebody that has means to them, kind of a wealthy person, not a man of power in the way that we might use it today. Verse 2, "And he had a choice and a handsome son whose name was Saul. There was not a more handsome person than he among the children of Israel. From his shoulders upward, he was taller than any of the people." It's interesting that being good looking is oftentimes the description. David was described that way. Absalom was described that way. I believe Jonathan was described that way. Saul was described that way, as if it was part of it. But they were handsome. They were handsome people. David wasn't tall, but this one he's saying he's tall and handsome. David was ruddy and good-looking and all of that. It's just interesting that that plays a part into it. But also, Saul was a head taller than anyone else. He was good-looking and had this good presence about him. And a lot of times throughout history, that's how people looked. If they were tall, it was automatically a stature of power and strength in that way. Verse 3. That is going to help out tremendously. Oh, don't apologize. You're helping me. Thank you very much. I like how it's just like, oh. Thank you. Verse 3. Thank you very much for hearing that and then jumping to it. Appreciate it. Verse 3. "Now the donkeys of Kish, Saul's father, was lost," or were lost, "and Kish said to his son Saul, 'Please take one of the servants..." We're beginning. Okay. "Take one of your servants with you and arise and go look for the donkeys." Verse 4. "So he passed through the mountains of Ephraim and through the land of Shalisha, but they did not find them. They had passed through the land of Shaalam, and they were not there. Then he passed through the land of the Benjamites, but they did not find them. When they had come to the land of Zuph, Saul said to the servant who was with him, 'Come, let us return, lest my father cease caring about the donkeys and become worried about us.' And he said to him, 'Look now, there is this city, a man of God, in the city, a man of God, and he is an honorable man. All that he says surely comes to pass. So let us go there. Perhaps he can show us the way that we should go.' Then Saul said to the servant, 'But look, if we go, what shall we bring the man? For the bread in our vessels is all gone, and there is no present to bring the man of God. What do we have?' And a servant answered Saul and again said, 'Look, I have here a hand, 1/4 of a shekel of silver. I will give that to the man of God to tell us our way.'" So something important to see here is the confusion The worry, the frustration, the aggravation, the exhaustion, all of a sudden they're thinking, you know, Father's going to be worried about us. There's a lot going on, with something that God was well informed of. What's playing out in the lives of Saul and the servant, they have no idea. They just can't find what they're looking for. They're frustrated. I wouldn't say they're necessarily lost, but they are looking for help. It's all not working to plan. There's a lot going on in their life. They can't find the donkeys and are led toward asking for help. With Saul and his servant, this is a plan, or part of the plan. They don't realize that. We'll see that in a moment. Verse 9. Formerly in Israel, when a man went to inquire of God, he spoke thus, "Come, let us go to the seer, for he who is now called a prophet was formerly called a seer." I think this is a neat part of history when we're reading this, when looking at this. This was something a later editor added. It was not a part of the inspired word of God. Within that, verse 9 wasn't. It was not added to change scripture. It wasn't added to add doctrine. It wasn't added to do any of that. It was added to explain for a later reader. And I think that's pretty neat, being able to see that whenever it was written. Barnes has this. It says, "This is manifestly a gloss inserted in the older narrative by the later editor of sacred text to explain the use of the term." Because somebody at a later time that's reading it, and all of a sudden a seer, and you say, "What's a seer?" You don't see that very many other places. What is that? There was a term that was of historic nature that new readers of the time might not have understood. So obviously a prophet and a seer were the same thing, and that's what this person, who the editor, was trying to do. Expositor says verse 9 has been called the only example in the Old Testament of semantic change. It brings the historic modern-day reader up to speed, whenever that reader was at that time, brought them up to speed when they are reading it, to either teach from it, whatever it might be. And I think it's kind of neat just to be able to see that. It's clearly marked. We know what it is. It also gives you the idea that they were not adding to the Word of God, but explaining it. They didn't go through scriptures to change all the words to seer and prophet. They didn't do that. Any place that it uses seer, they didn't go through and say, "Okay, now we've got to change it to prophet." That would be changing something that they shouldn't. They didn't do it. They kept it in its original form. Verse 10 says, "Then Saul said to his servant, 'Well said, come, let us go.' So they went to the city where the man of God was. As they went up the hill to the city, they met some young women going out to draw water and said to them, 'Is the seer here?'" So now, obviously, because of verse 9, we know prophet. "And they answered them and said, 'Yes, there he is, just ahead of you. Hurry now, for today he came to this city, because there is a sacrifice of the people today on the high place.'" Now, I found this interesting. I'm sure you've read through the Bible and you've seen many, many places where sacrificing on the high places was a big no-no. It wasn't something that you were supposed to do, and all of a sudden, now we have Samuel going to the high place. Actually, when you read through the later kings, it was part of a major reform to remove the high places. To clean up everything was to remove the high places whenever there was a reform. High places were most often associated with wrong and pagan worship. I was reading some things, and a lot of it was Canaanite worship. When they would move into the area, they kept it the same, and all of a sudden they're sacrificing on the same high places, and then it was easy enough just to bring in some of that Canaanite pagan worship and doing a lot of that. But it was something that was needed to be cleansed from the land. Here, Samuel, a prophet of God, is going to sacrifice on the high place for the people. After reading many things, here's an explanation that I got. And I like this. After you kind of dig in, once I ask the question, I kind of have to go down the rabbit hole of why and do the best I can to come up with the answer. And I think I found some really good things. This I got from Zondervan Illustrated Bible Background Commentary. Excuse me. I brought tea up with me, and it is blazing hot. Ooh. We wanted to keep it warm, and it has worked. Oh. My tongue is on fire. That is amazing. Okay, it says, "In the period between destruction of the sanctuary at Shiloh and the building of the temple in Jerusalem, built by Solomon, that time period in there, worship of Yahweh at the high places was something conducted without explicit censure as here." It wasn't something that was spoken so bad about or just reprimanded. That's interesting as we quickly go over to 1 Kings. Let's go to 1 Kings 3. 1 Kings 3. In verse 1, 1 Kings 3, starting in verse 1, this is time of Solomon, and this is when he is asked, or he asks for wisdom, asks for help, so he has that conversation with God, but right before that, said, now Solomon, verse 1, 1 Kings 3, verse 1, now Solomon made a treaty with Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and married Pharaoh's daughter. Then he brought her to the city of David until he had finished building his own house, and the house of the Lord, and the wall all around them. Meanwhile, so it's not finished yet, meanwhile the people sacrificed at the high places because there was no house built for the name of the Lord until those days. Let's go ahead and read on. And Solomon loved the Lord, walking in the statutes of his father, David, except that he sacrificed and burnt incense at the high places. Now the king went to Gibeon and sacrificed there, for there was the great high place. Solomon offered 1,000 burnt offerings on that altar. At Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream by night, and God said, ask, what shall I give you? So there's a whole narrative there that's going on. We get the same feeling here that this was not ideal. It wasn't what was supposed to be. But as Sonsino writes, this was condoned more along the lines of just allowed. This was condoned despite the injunction in Deuteronomy 12, 13 and 14. We won't go there. Because there was no house. There was no place to go. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown uses the word tolerated. It wasn't that it was a just all-out accepted type of worship to go up on the high places. That was still something that was not necessarily the way things were to be, but it was allowed, it was tolerated, it was condoned during a time that they didn't have a place to go. There's no great defined area of where the tabernacle was. Remember, the ark was in Kirjath Jearim at someone's house, but that it was not necessarily within the tabernacle. It's not defined well where that is, so they don't have a place to go. So it's not ideal for that moment in time. It was, again, condoned, tolerated, without explicit censure, which means strong, without strong approval or disapproval or harsh criticism. So we're looking at this, and that's one of the things that stand out. How does Samuel, the man of God, go to a high place? Well, that's a place that was more or less tolerated at this time before the temple and the house of God is actually built during that time period. Verse 13, as soon as you come into the city, you will surely find him before he goes up to the high place to eat. For the people will not eat until it comes because he must bless the sacrifice. Afterward, those who are invited will eat. Now, therefore, go up for about this time, you will find him. So they went up to the city as they were coming into the city. There was Samuel coming out toward them on his way up to the high place. So go on, verse 15. Now the Lord had told Samuel in his ear, the day before Saul came, saying, tomorrow about this time I will send you a man from the land of Benjamin, and you shall anoint him commander over my people, Israel, that he may save my people from the hand of the Philistines. For I have looked upon my people because their cry has come to me. What seems to be a frustrating thing to Saul and his servant to lose the donkeys was part of the plan to get Saul to Samuel. God was working it out. Saul was one of those people that's getting frustrated because he can't find the donkeys, but it's all being worked out. And I think sometimes we can relate that to our lives. Look back on it and you say, oh yeah, I was looking for donkeys and I was getting frustrated about that, but God had completely different plans. He was drawing me towards something. Also, something else interesting is that God clearly states that these are his people. They're not the king's. They're his people. Even though there will be a king, a commander, they are God's people. Clearly, the king was to be a servant of God to serve the people of Israel because God was still over them. They were his. As we know the history of the kings, once you start operating outside of that, there are problems, and that's what we see. We see this progression throughout the kings where you start operating outside of that, being a servant to God, a servant to the people for God. Once you start going outside of that, there becomes bigger issues, and that's what we see at the very end when they go into captivity. Verse 17, so when Samuel saw Saul, that's not the easiest thing to say, the Lord said to him, there he is, the man of whom I spoke to you, this one shall reign over my people. Then Saul drew near to Samuel in the gate and said, please tell me, where is the seer's house? Samuel answered Saul and said, I am the seer. Go up before me to the high place, for you shall eat with me today, that's the sacrifice, and tomorrow I will let you go and tell you all that is in your heart. He's going to reveal to him more things. Verse 20, but as for your donkeys that were lost 3 days ago, but do not be anxious about them, for they have been found. And on whom is all the desire of Israel? It's kind of one of those things. We can stop there for a second. What was the desire of Israel? Well, Israel's desire at this time was to have a king. Again, chapter 8, verse 19 says, nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel, and they said, no, but we will have a king over us. That was the desire of Israel. That's what they were looking for. And then Samuel said, remember, go to your homes. This will be worked out. What you requested, that was the desire of Israel. That was clear to Saul what the desire of Israel was. So when Samuel says that, he's hearing those words. He knows what that's talking about. If somebody came to you and said, what is the desire of Israel? We would be confused. But it's something that he understood. Then Samuel adds something else to the statement. Verse 20 again. Let's just read from a mid part. It says, on whom is all the desire of Israel? Well, the king. Is it not you, on you, and on your father's house? This would have been perplexing. I can see him across the table looking wide-eyed and thinking, I just lost my donkeys. That's it. That's all I did. I don't know why you're asking me this. I don't know why you're presenting this to me. And also, I kind of get the feeling like I found you. Remember, I came knocking on your door. I was looking for the seer. You didn't come find me. Samuel is saying that he would be king of Israel. He would be the king that Israel was looking for. All of this becomes, all of a sudden, this massive weight on his shoulders. Verse 21, and Saul answered and said to him, am I not a Benjamite of the smallest of the tribes of Israel, and my family the least of all the families of the tribes of Benjamin? Why then do you speak like this to me? Why the smallest of the tribes? Do we remember the story of why the smallest of the tribes? Let's go back to the story of the judges. Which historically at this point is not far in the past. This would be something that they would remember. It's not far. It's one of the last stories of the judges. Let's go to Judges 20. Judges 20. Now, Judges 20 is about when Israel fought against the Benjamites. I don't want to review the story of why. I think it is an appalling story. It's hard to go over. It's full of depravity. But this is the end result. It's one of those stories that just makes you scratch your head, how somebody could act this way leading up to it. But Israel does not appreciate it. Israel does not like it. And so they battle against the Benjamites. Let's pick it up in verse 46. It says, all who fell of Benjamin that day were 25,000 men who drew the sword. All these were men of valor. So their military just wiped out. But 600 men turned and fled towards the wilderness to the Rock of Rimmon. And they stayed at the Rock of Rimmon for 4 months. And the men of Israel turned back against the children of Benjamin and struck them down with the edge of the sword. They weren't done. They went through to wipe them out completely. From every city, men and beasts, all who were found, they also set fire to the cities that they came to. You look at that. Benjamin was absolutely destroyed and laid waste. They wanted to wipe them out. Just no longer part of the 10 tribes of Israel. Israel had to come up with a plan after this massacre to preserve Benjamin, otherwise they would have been wiped out. There had to be something to preserve them, and they come up with this plan. And by the time that we have 1 Samuel 9, verse 21, their numbers had not recovered to the same level as all the other tribes at that point. Not enough time anyway has passed. So the statement, my family, the least of all the families, was a statement now of humility. So the first, we're the smallest tribe. Yes, physically, you are the smallest tribe. Still, next to insignificant compared to the other tribes. But then he does say, my family. My family. Now we're not talking about Benjamites. We're talking about my family within the Benjamites being the least of all the families. And that was actually a good start to Saul. It shows you Saul's heart. Saul was not always, a lot of times we get this picture of Saul as being this psychotic, kind of this brute beast sometimes, and he has a lot of issues. He's angry, he's violent, and all of those check off. Yes, 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 yes. But there's also another side to Saul that wasn't like that, especially at the beginning. There was a side of humility. Then he asked a question many of us would ask. Why are you saying these things to me? Why would that possibly be what you're saying? Out of everyone, why would you be saying that? Verse 22. Now Samuel took Saul and his servant and brought them into the hall and had them sit in the place of honor among those who were invited. There were about 30 persons. Let me check my time. About 30 persons. And Samuel said to the cook, bring the portion which I gave you, of which I said to you, set it apart. So the cook took up the thigh with its upper part and set it before Saul. And Samuel said, here it is, what was kept back, it was set apart for you, eat, for until this time it has been kept for you, since I said I invited the people. So Saul ate with Samuel that day. Samuel is saying, you didn't find me. You were brought to me. It's a whole different thing. There's a plan being played out. Saul would slowly be recognizing that there was a bigger picture being played out here. Verse 25. When they had come down from the high place into the city, Samuel spoke with Saul on the top of the house. They arose early, and it was about the dawning of the day that Samuel called to Saul in the top of the house, saying, get up, that I may send you on your way. And Saul arose, and both of them went outside, he and Samuel. As they were going down to the outskirts of the city, Samuel said to Saul, tell the servant to go on ahead of us, meaning this is not a message to him. Then he says something that you put yourself in that place. And he went on, but you stand here a while, that I may announce to you the word of God. I love thinking about that. I couldn't imagine what was filling the mind of Saul at this point. There's so many things happening. This is all much bigger than him. It's all massive to him. But verse 27 got me thinking, what if you or me was told, you stand here a while, then I will announce to you the word of God. Say a man comes in, sends all of you out, and you're standing here, and it is a prophet, and he says, wait here for a moment. I'm going to announce to you the word of God. God would speak to Samuel, and those words would be told to you. Through a messenger, you would be hearing the words of God meant only for your ears. That is an outstanding thing to think about, especially for somebody in Saul's mind. I'm of the lowliest family, at least. God has a message for you. To me, this is the biggest moment of those two chapters, when all of a sudden Saul's standing there, and in a moment, he's going to hear a message from God to him. That is big. To me, again, that is the biggest of the two chapters. Well, that's where we're going to leave it now, where I wanted to finish. Mr. Henson will pick this up with that monumental moment that he's going to hear God's message. He's waiting for that time, and take it from that going on. Probably, I don't know if he'll take a chapter at a time, two chapters, three chapters, but this is more of the pace at which I believe that we will be taking it. So that's it for Bible study. We do have 38 minutes until services, so any snacks, anything like that, go ahead and do that, and we will go ahead and end. So, oh, there's a couple announcements. Yeah.